Welcome back to the Evolution of Snake. I'm Zach.
And I'm Madeline.
And this is our Scott Swift origin story. Now, we have to let you know that there has been a lot going on in the Taylor Nation as of late. Subjects that have been so deep and complex that we think they deserve their own deep dives. So today we're going to be talking about the origin story of Taylor Swift, prompted by the resurfacing of a couple of emails in a lawsuit filed against Scott Swift by Taylor Swift's former manager. But we also have, for all of you who have not subscribed to our Patreon, we have done a deep dive into the end of the Gaylor conspiracy theory. Whether you realize it or not, Gaylor has been ended by CNN after a New York Times op-ed was posted and caused a bit of a kerfuffle and ignited a response from Taylor Swift. So we have a 45-minute episode up on the Patreon. This is an extra episode on top of all the other extra content that you get behind the paywall at patreon.com/swiftologist. So make sure to check that out. But today I'm so excited because we are doing something that doesn't often happen when we do our scripted episodes, but we have Madeline the Bone Collector back to lead. Last time she was here, we made history
actually.
Our Ashley Leachin.
Yeah, that was crazy. I can't believe we did that. Like, when I'm reflecting on it, I'm like, I cannot believe we did that. That's probably the shadiest thing we've ever done.
It was insane. It was a boots.
It was a wig. It was a house down. It was everything. And we did it with a plum.
It shocked people.
We did it with a plum. That's my opinion. We did it with class and elegance.
We did it with...
And that's exactly
and that's exactly what we're doing today.
Class, elegance, and aplomb.
So, Madeline, why don't you give us a little taste of why we decided to do this episode and what we can expect?
So, we decided to do this episode because the Taylor Swift origin story and the Scott Swift origin story, one might argue they're one and the same, are deeply mysterious and enigmatic stories that capture the mind. They ensnare the soul. They leave us questioning. They leave us wondering. They leave us asking. And there are a couple, I don't want to say many, but there are a couple of different origin stories that have been told over the years about Miss Taylor Swift. And I think that both of us decided that the Scott Swift email was perhaps the most true vision into how and why Taylor became Taylor Swift. How she got a record deal is really what it boils down to. A lot of people have said her dad paid for it, this, that, or the other thing. The email pretty much proves that that did not happen. He did have the money to fund it, but he did not buy that record deal, ladies and gentlemen. So we are here to set the story straight. I have three different categories. I have the origin story as told to us by one, Taylor Swift, and Andrea is also largely featured because she's kind of like the Taylor mouthpiece, I would say, especially in the early years.
Partner
and then
crime.
I have the origin story as told to us by Scott Borchetta, who has like more of a business sort of angle to it that's interesting, I think. And then there's what the email told us. So those are my three categories.
I think this is a very worthy topic. And also, I think where a lot of confusion and rumors about Ms. Swift have arisen from over the years. So we were talking about the Scott Swift email and we felt as though it did reveal things to us that we kind of knew, but put like into perspective how true they were. And I think our overarching thesis is that, you know, Taylor gets accused of being a Nepo baby pretty often by her detractors, that she had some sort of industry insider leg up into becoming where she is. And that is patently not true. That really is not true. What she did have was two parents with the business sense and the expendable resources and disposable income required to devote themselves entirely to cashing out Taylor Swift's noticeable talent. So really what they did was spot that Taylor was pretty prodigious at a young age. They heard from many people around them as they were kind of like wetting their toes into the Taylor Swift business side of things, how rare and excellent she was. Scott, being a good businessman, identified an opportunity and a gap in the market. And by God, he made it happen. So I think... the way that Madeline has done the research and broken it down, I think dispels a lot of the rumors. And also, I think reinforces that Taylor's not a Nepo baby, but she is certainly a very privileged girly who would not be where she is by any stretch of the imagination without the careful attention and assistance of Scott Swift in particular.
Exactly. Now.
And both of her parents are like portrayed as these like bumbling, homely, happy-go-lucky, hand-heart Swifties, basically. Scott Swift always has been kind of presented as a little bit of a joker. He just rides a Segway and gives out guitar picks. This portrayal of how her parents are and what their family unit is could not be further from the actual truth. And I think that's what I found to be very interesting. And I understand, like, it's not a very marketable story to be like, my dad's a shark, basically, and that's how I got to where I am. But it is interesting that our like my understanding of who Scott Swift and Andrea Swift are has really changed over the years.
Oh yeah. Even just like, I mean, I don't know why Taylor is so obsessed with the idea of like, you made a rebel of a careless man's careful daughter, leaving like a father, shit like that. I don't know. I don't presume to know. I don't speculate. But you never hear her saying you made a rebel of a careless woman's careful daughter, now do ya? The main impression that I've always gotten that has only been so much reinforced by the Scott Swift email is that Taylor and Andrea are BFF linked at the hip and Scott is some guy that has a wallet. That is exactly the dynamic, and it's fucking crazy to me. It cracks me up.
Long and short of it. Well, take it away, Lizard.
So let's start with the origin story as told to us by the Queen, Miss Taylor Swift, and of course also Andrea is also spouting off in here as well. So there is an origin story that has been repeated and repeated and repeated since 2006. It's probably one that I could have done off the top of my head, but I went back and I watched old interviews, and let me tell you, I was charmed. I was like, wow, look at this beautiful girl in the prime of her life.
It's a great story.
That's the gag. So starting at the very, very beginning, Taylor was always drawn to country music and got her first country album when she was 6, which was the first Leon Rimes album called Blue. And I said, home wrecking was taught to her young. I don't remember a lot of the notes I wrote. I will never let Leanne Rimes fucking breathe. If she comes up, I'm saying she's a home
You
wrecker.
Won't. You I'm will sorry, never get
I,
off her
like,
neck.
I'm not even like an anti-
Brandy
exactly.
Glanville,
I'm,
life
I'm
ruined.
A, I guess I'm a Brandy Glanville devotee. I don't know. She's a fucking home wrecker.
You are.
So,
I understand.
She learned home wrecking young from Leanne Rimes. And then she said that she wanted to be a country artist because she went to a Leanne Rimes concert. And she knew that she wanted to be a superstar because when Leanne Rimes saw her and singled her out in the crowd and made her feel special, she said, and I just want to be able to do that for some little girl out there. I want to be able to do that for just one kid. And if I could even do that for one kid, I know that I've done. Yeah,
Taylor's it's like, me. It's me.
I'm Leanne Rimes. Me. I'm going to be Leanne Rimes.
Me.
Don't. You can't fight the moonlight. You
I will
cannot fight the moonlight.
Give me the chance. I'll wreck every home. Every home you have, I will wreck.
And I really enjoy the way that Taylor, in her really early career, constantly gives praise to the female country artists who came before her. She's constantly talking about Leanne Rimes, constantly talking about Faith Hill, constantly talking about Martina McBride, Miranda Lambert. She loved Kelly Pickler,
Shania,
all these women. She was like, they paved the way for me to be here.
Kelly Pickler,
and I think it's
yeah.
really interesting because I kind of think that's the way she feels about herself. She's like, I feel like these girls need to, because I did it for the people who came before me. The girls need to do it that they're coming after me. And for the most part, they have been.
Show some
And for
respect.
The most part, they have been kissing. They've been kissing the boot. They've been kissing the ring and kissing the boot.
Mm-hmm.
So
as they should.
Absolutely fucking
But
should.
Sometimes when they do that, it's not enough, as we've seen.
So Taylor says that when she was around 10 years old, she started dragging her parents to festivals and fairs and karaoke nights and was singing everywhere she possibly could. And then she visited Nashville when she was 11 after she heard Faith Hill say that Nashville is where she got her start. Well, that's where I have to go. That's what she said.
Okay.
She
it's
begged her
out.
Parents to take her to
it's
Nashville.
It's checking out.
Taylor went with her parents and had a demo CD. And she says she would walk into every major record label in Nashville and go, hi, I'm Taylor. I want a record deal. I have heard her say that so many fucking
this
times.
This is an essential part of the lore.
Hi, I'm Taylor.
Essential.
Can I have a record deal? Can I have a record deal?
I want
and
a record
like,
deal. And that's such a Taylor
right,
thing to
it is
do.
Very Taylor.
To walk in and be like, I would please like a record deal. Can I also just say that if I was a patron at a bar in a one horse town and Taylor Swift came in with her parents and started doing karaoke, I would get up and leave.
Yes.
Oh. I would be like, leave me out
so
of this.
Pissed.
This delusion that you have. Because she was always a songwriter, but she was not a singer. She was not a singer. Especially not at this time.
Every woman, it's all in me. The like one of the worst covers of all time.
That would be a, it's bar time.
It's bar time. Come on. You got to get out. Come
time
on.
To close the bar.
We're 12
down.
Year olds in here. Come on. Get fucking serious. So
she wants a record deal. She says, I'm Taylor. I want
But of course,
deal.
She was rejected. And this was in Journey to Fearless. This is where I got this little tidbit. She was used to rejection by that point. And she tells a story in Journey to Fearless about asking all her friends to go to the mall. All of them say, no, they're busy. My mom won't let me. So she asks her mom to take her to the mall. And who do they see at the mall? All of Taylor's so-called friends hanging out without her. She truly was a loser.
Bitches.
She was a fucking loser. She said during this time she was doing everything she could.
That's what you need to understand about her.
She was a fucking loser. I believe it too. She said she was doing everything she could to quote-unquote fit in, down to straightening her hair, and she'd be terrified of her friends or schoolmates reading something in the paper about, for example, her performing the national anthem because the kids at school would torment her about it and make fun of her. I believe that hook, line, and sinker. In Pennsylvania? Oh, yeah. I would make fun of that dumb little bitch and her little headband and her shiny American flag.
Well, yes.
Her white pants.
Well, yes. In middle school, you cannot draw attention to yourself. You can't. And
no.
Even if you don't, you're going to get made fun of.
Yep.
So going on TV and saying, God bless America, I mean, firing squad. You're lighting yourself up for it.
You should die. And she did. She died every day in school for a year
straight.
She
hated it. And it was the founding wrong.
But now this is where the things get kind of interesting for the story. She says the Nashville trip made her realize that she needed to be different. It's the things that made her stand out that would really make her, you know, pop in Nashville, not in Pennsylvania, not in Reading, Pennsylvania. Is that what it was? Reading? That's what it was, right?
Mm. Yep. Wyoming. Wyoming.
Wyoming. She couldn't just have a demo CD of her doing karaoke of other people's songs. She said that.
Well, that's because you can't sing. Well, that really is. That's why.
That's
she
unspoken.
Realized.
That's
the pipes
unspoken. Yep.
Weren't piping, and yep. If we wanted to be successful, we had to pivot. That's really what this is about.
That's what this whole thing is about, and that comes up again in the Scott Swift email too. That comes up again. So she needed to stand out and be a songwriter. This is when she, quote unquote, picked up a 12-string guitar and started playing and writing my own music. That's what she said in Journey to Fearless. She said that her first guitar was a 6-string that she got when she was 8 or 9, but her hands were too small.
Teeny
little Taylor hands. So she kept it in a corner. And then she says when she was about 12, the guy who her parents hired to come fix their family computer saw the guitar in the corner and asked her if she played. And she said, no, I tried, but my hands are too small. And he said, I can teach you a few chords.
And that man changed the course of history forever.
And I think that he should be getting loyalty checks from the Swifts.
Oh, he should be getting a Nobel Peace Prize.
Without that 12 string, she's nothing. She is absolutely nothing. She's absolutely nothing. So then she has like a little girl power reason for why she started playing a 12 string. This is what she said in a separate interview. She initially started on a 6-string and taking lessons with a 6-string, but said she had a real jerk of a guitar teacher who, when Taylor asked what the difference was between a 6-string and a 12-string guitar, said, I don't need to answer that for you because there's no way you'll be able to learn a 12-string anyway.
Boo.
The next day, she went and picked out the 12-string guitar that she wanted, asked for it for Christmas, received it for Christmas, and she says she played it every single day till her fingers bled. And that's on Girl
this
Power.
This reminds me. That's on Girl Power, and this reminds me of people underestimate the lengths to which I will go to inconvenience myself in order to make a point.
So true.
Foundational pillar character trait.
Exactly. So the very first song that she ever wrote on her 12-string guitar, Mama named her Lucky on a Starling, had a bunny foot in her pocket. She dances in spite of the fact that she's different, and yet she's the same. And she says,
"This is Miranda Lambert."
Now that, and I have to give it to her, I actually kind of think that song slaps
for a first song.
Yeah, for a first song,
for a first pancake.
Lucky you.
Well, all right then.
Like it kind of
Gracie
the
Abrams
melody.
Could never.
Ooh, that melody girl. Mm-mm. Yes. Give it to us, sister. So this is what she says about what Lucky You is about. Lucky You is about a girl who was a little bit different from everybody else. And, well, that describes our girl just perfectly. She was a loner loser with no friends. So, yes, Mama named her Lucky on just, a starlit night.
That's her life.
Honestly, she should put Lucky You on debut TV as like the first song she ever wrote. I mean,
yes, it's lore. It's come lore. On, and it's not that bad. There are worse songs.
No, there are way there worse are songs. There are worse songs. One. If I was Andrea and Scott and I heard her doing that, I'd be like, this kid is a fucking prodigy.
Mozart. No wonder. Mozart. They heard it and said, now hold on. We don't need to be doing karaoke. We do not need to be doing karaoke. Absolutely we don't need not. To be singing, no, 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 Man, no. I Feel Like a Woman.
No. Nope. Nope. We absolutely
get
need
that
to be
guitar.
Doing Lucky You. Lucky
start you. Strumming.
Angelina's Strum. Got a pretty face and really long brown hair. So, here's some more bullying information. Andrea says that Taylor would sit down at a table during lunch and everyone would get up and move. God damn it. Mm. All haters. Because, this is what I wrote, all because she wore a patriotic, sparkly American flag shirt and sang the national anthem at the 76ers game. In hindsight, surely we know those kids were jealous. Well, yes.
Period.
I mean, a little bit, mm-hmm. I would imagine. I mean, it's dorky as
it
hell.
It was a cool thing to do.
But she
whether
had
you make
microphone.
Fun of her or not.
Exactly.
She's famous.
She was on the Megatron. And where were you that Sunday, Carly? Mm-hmm.
At home.
At home.
On the water slide.
Chips and dip, weren't you?
Not good.
So... here's a little bit of the most important Taylor Swift lore. So the Swifts, this is what was said in Journey to Fearless, mind you. They decided to move to Nashville when RCA, correct? Yeah, RCA Records offered her a development deal. And the development deal is, as Taylor described it, we believe in you, kind of. That's what she said. We're going to watch you and see how you develop, but we're not making an album right now. And Andrea
yeah, it's like
said,
a training period.
Yeah. This
They're
is what
like,
she was 13.
We're in it,
yeah,
but we're not fully committed to it.
Which is kind of fair, like with a 13-year-old whose best song is Lucky You.
Give her a year.
Give her a year.
Give her a year. It's not the Disney Channel.
Yeah.
Because keep in mind, she wasn't trying to be, I think this is important too, she wasn't trying to be a children's entertainer. That was never the goal. She was always trying to get an actual record deal to make real music, which is a harder mountain to climb when you're 13.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Obviously.
This was not the Mickey Mouse Club. This was not Selena Gomez. No, 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 no,
no,
no. She was trying to do country. Mm-hmm. And, well, Andrea says her and Taylor would go to the record label sometimes once a week with new songs that Taylor had written. And the label would be like, wow, anyway. And they
That's how I would feel yeah. if I got presented with...
Angelina
$10 and a six pack
didn't
come
they?
On Smoky Black Nights they'd be like, oh, you wrote a 9/11 song this week, that's entertaining,
that's interesting.
A choice that you made.
A child that was how old when 9/11 happened, you say? A child who wasn't even in New York at the time. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Nope. We'll let her rock.
We're just going to let her rock on that one. So they weren't saying, let's make a record. And this is, again, pivotal. At the end of that year, they had the option to either sign her or just watch her for another year. And they said, well, we're not ready to offer you an actual record deal, but we can keep the development deal. And Taylor said, up your fat ass.
She said, big mistake.
Huge. She walks out and she felt like they were stringing her along. And Andrea was like, are you fucking kidding me?
She's girly.
Like, no, hold on.
Let's go develop.
This is what
we need to keep
said.
Developing.
I kind of feel like Andrea, like, I know it's a better story this way, but I feel like probably in real life, Andrea was like, you're so right, Taylor. You're so
yeah.
right.
Yeah. And also Scott probably made this decision, not Taylor.
Well.
That's, I think, also, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Taylor was certain that RCA was not the place for her because she felt like they didn't believe in her. And I mean, clearly they didn't. Meanwhile, Scott Borchetta heard five chords of Lucky You and said, we need to get this girl a fucking microphone and a curly guitar. And we need it all.
Boots on.
Curler.
Headset mic.
Hair curler out. Gloves on.
Headline.
Let's
stadium.
Go.
Go.
Yes, go. So this is another very important part of the story. This is like the story that I thought was 100% reality up until very recently. I mean, I'm not saying that's not, but like, this is the thing that I was like, this is 100% true and there's no factual inaccuracies with it whatsoever. It's so important to the lore of Taylor Swift. So after she walks away from RCA, obviously she's walking around. She almost had a record deal and she lost it. And now she's just another dumb bitch walking the streets of Nashville with a guitar. And those are a dime a dozen. Those are literally a dime a dozen. So
at this point, there are 100 Taylor Swifts.
Right. But then a twist of fate, she does a showcase at a place called the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville, Tennessee. Oh my God. Ah, the crowd's going wild. We love
I went there.
The Bluebird Cafe.
It's it was closed. I looked in the windows.
And you felt the presence, didn't you?
I did.
You felt the presence.
I felt it. It was a little run down. I don't know what I was expecting.
No,
but it's not the Starbucks premium roasters in Seattle. It's not that.
No, it is definitely not that. And thank God I went there.
Thank God.
That is the worst Starbucks on earth. I wouldn't go there for if you paid me.
Luckily, it's the Bluebird Cafe.
Luckily for us. So guess who happened to be in the audience at the Bluebird Cafe? A man who needs no introduction. It is Scott Borchetta. She claims
owner of Stolen Lullabies.
He was merely a man in the audience who happened to hear songs and was like, wow, she's the real deal. Get you know, like a traditional like record deal guy with a cigar. Get this girl a record deal. Stat, Cindy. Bring me the contract.
You call up my assistant and tell her that she's got a new star on her hands.
You're like, you know, in Back to the Future. Have you seen that? Were they like, he's playing. Okay, well, never mind. Nobody gets my references. Nobody gets my references around here anyway. So apparently, this is what was said. He offered her a record deal essentially right there and then. But he said, my label does not exist yet. So Taylor would have to take a chance on a brand new label. And essentially a strange man who was just in the audience saying, hey, I have an idea. It's kind of crazy. When you really think about it, it's like a strange man that looks like Scott Borchetta, by the way, who's like not, I mean, you know.
He doesn't look legit. He kind of looks like a scammer.
He looks like a grifter. He looks like a grifter. He looks like...
His hair. Yeah, there's something about him that's like...
The slick hair. You know what
greasy.
I mean? Slicked back.
I don't trust him.
We were right.
You know, I think also coming to her with a fictitious label as well. It's like, hey, here's a record deal that doesn't exist because there's no label. So here's a wish and a dream. And she said, well,
Mama named her Lucky on a starlit night. That's what she said.
She said, I got to boots this.
I absolutely have to boots this 100%. And that's exactly what she did. She said in Journey to Fearless, she wanted to be a part of building something from the ground up. And when I heard her say that, I was like, it made me feel really sad. Because like she
me
was,
too.
She made
it's painful to
yeah.
hear.
She made.
She believed
that label.
In Scott.
Yeah.
She believed in their partnership. Yep. She believed that he would do everything in his power to make her successful.
Yep.
And you know, for a time that was true. I wouldn't go back and say it was all fake. I mean, there was certainly more resistance than we realize. But yeah, this is a very sanitized version of how that happened.
Well, I tell you what, it's a good story. I clap. I mean,
oh, it's easy to understand.
I
it's clapped. Easy to follow.
I clap.
It places Taylor as the agent.
Yes.
She's the person that is making all the decisions.
Right.
And when you really think about it, it's kind of absurd to think that a 13-year-old is looking at her Sony development deal and first of all, understanding really what that means.
Right.
And then being like, oh, they're having the foresight to be like, they're just going to keep me forever. So I'm going to go somewhere else. Like we had adults in the background telling her what to do for sure. And that's nothing to be ashamed of.
Exactly.
But it does disrupt the narrative that Taylor is at the helm of the career from get-go.
Any of these discrepancies that I found when I was searching this, it didn't really bother me because I was like, well, is it a good story that Scott Borchetta knew a guy?
You
got to
tell
a
story.
Yeah.
I was born on a Christmas tree farm.
I was born.
It has to be that, you know, it makes more sense. I don't begrudge her for it.
No,
at all.
I clap. This is the thing. I clap. I cheer. And I still think that the Bluebird Cafe is a sacred place. I don't care what anybody says. It's sacred.
Oh, absolutely. Hallowed ground.
Holy land. This is a state of grace.
A pilgrimage to which we will make one day.
Exactly.
We'll go there.
We will go there. Maybe that's where Evolution of Mistake Live will be at the Bluebird Cafe. And the girls will gag.
And we'll cry. We'll get on the stage and get down to our knees.
Is he out there? Scott Borchetta?
I can't believe it.
Where are you? Come up here.
We need a record deal.
Beat the shit out of you.
Come for your flogging, sir.
Yes. Come up for your spanking. Come on. All right. Well, speaking of the man, next up, my next section. This is the Scott Borchetta origin story featuring...
Creepier than I remembered it when I read it in black and white. Creepier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a
lot
creepier.
Wait till we get into this.
Skeezy, creepy man.
So, in 1997, set the scene. Scott Borchetta was fired from a record label executive position at MCA Nashville.
For being a flop.
And I want to know why. Nobody ever says
why. Yeah, for being a flop.
Tell us why.
I'd love to know.
I'd love to know. The inquiring minds want to know. I don't have that information. I couldn't get it. Then
we'll get it
2004, his new employer, DreamWorks Nashville, merged with MCA Nashville. And he was like, I don't want to be at this place that fired me, which I kind of understand. It's like, well, you guys are the people who dumped my ass. Now you're just going to put me in the same office? I don't think
so. You're
going to
do the same thing again. No thanks.
So in September of 2005, he decided he was going to roll the dice and start his own label. Okay, T. He says that while putting together the plans for his new, as of yet, non-existent label, he received a package from some random 14-year-old girly. And I wonder who that was. Who is she? What does she want? Was she named Lucky on a starlit night, perhaps?
Maybe. Did she have a ringlet in her hair?
Could it be?
Did her eyes put those Georgia stars to shame that night? Question? It's just a question.
It's just a question.
But this, I mean, this immediately contradicts Taylor's version of the story, which is that he saw her for the first time and plucked her out of obscurity. As you will soon start to be able to see, Scott Swift was
He was the mastermind. Yeah.
He was masterminding it all. How they even knew to send this to a person who was recently let go from their job. Maybe they thought he was still at the label doing A&R, and that's why they sent it to him. But it is interesting that they had identified this kind of lower level music executive to target.
And let me tell you, it worked out like gangbusters. It worked out like fucking gangbusters. Mm-hmm. So Scott says, this is what he said about the package. This is when I started to really crack up. So he found the package unique. And what he found really unique was the Abercrombie & Fitch modeling that Taylor had done.
Of all the things, not Lucky You.
Not Lucky You.
It was Abercrombie & Fitch modeling.
Not Smokey Black Nights. No, it was her Abercrombie & Fitch modeling. If you haven't seen the spread, you should go check it out just to see how deranged it was that he was so intrigued by this photo shoot.
It's kind of like, it's not that amazing.
No.
There's nothing that interesting about it.
No, it's nothing to write home about, but... He mentions being really into it multiple times. This is like the smoking gun to him, is the Abercrombie & Fitch fucking modeling. It shunked me.
See, he saw a product. He didn't just see a girl with a story to tell, which is another part of the myth, right? That he saw this beautiful storytelling potential. When we hear this version of it, he was like, oh, this girl looks like a pop star. She looks like she's pretty and we can sell her.
Well, this is what he says. He says, quote, Taylor's a very attractive girl. You couldn't tell whether she was 14 or 21. And I'm here to say, yes,
that.
You could. You could tell she
I
was 14.
That.
You could tell
it
she was 14.
It was so obvious.
It was so gross.
You are not really looking at that girl and thinking she looks 21. Wasn't it also an Abercrombie and Fitch kids modeling spread?
Yes. Yes, this was Child's Magazine. This was like young people teen magazine. This is not for Scott Borchetta and his tissues in his fucking office.
No wonder she didn't have it in herself to go with Grace. I mean, come on. This is nonsense.
Mind-boggling to me that everybody just said, oh yeah, Scott Borchetta, that's normal. So this is why he brings up her looking 21. So here's what he says. He says that in country music at that time, country music was not for teenagers. Like, thinking about it, even going as far back as like 10, 15 years ago, pretty much, I mean, we could say like, oh, look at Kelsea Ballerini, look at Kacey Musgraves, look at all these younger, I mean, Maddie and Tay, like all these young women who started doing country music. They started doing it because Taylor Swift broke out, because before that,
period,
there wasn't females in country, not to that scale, and they were not young. Even there was Shania Twain, it was Martina McBride. There was no young teen girl demographic for country music.
The last star I can remember breaking out as like a female country artist right before Taylor was Carrie Underwood, and she broke out with noted anthem Before He Cheats, but that's about being a scorned woman. That's really, I mean, Taylor was kind of writing about that in a different sense, but that was a mature lady's perspective. It was about being at the bar. It was about smashing up the headlights. It wasn't
that was a woman's
teardrops
song.
On my guitar.
Exactly. And what was the other tidbit that I got? So during Taylor's debut era, this is interesting. She was the first woman in 10 years to be on the top 10 country chart. Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
Makes you want to kill yourself. 10 years.
Yeah. That's really depressing.
Yeah.
And I think, you know what? Some of the best country artists are women. I mean, country music is a storytelling medium, and women tell stories better than anyone.
And meanwhile, you got the men over here going, load up my car and load up my trailer, go down.
Number one.
Number one.
For weeks on end.
Number one.
I mean, it all comes down to the demographics, right?
Exactly.
And at that time, it is true that young women weren't listening to country music. And a little girl called Taylor Swift said, but they would. If I was writing it.
That's exactly what she said too. I've watched another interview where that's essentially what she said.
That's the bet. Because she was a little freak for listening to like Shania Twain at the age of nine.
I mean, it was kind of freakish.
What are you finding there?
That was freakish.
She wasn't listening to Britney Spears. I mean, I'm sure she was, but she never talks about like the pop stars that influenced her when she was younger. So it always surprises me when she comes out. She's like, I used to love Nelly. I'm like, when? You were sitting at home turning up Faith Hill.
Yeah, you were turning up Faith Hill. The closest she got to being a pop girly was listening to Britney, but who wasn't, may I ask?
Yeah, you couldn't. You couldn't not.
She was the queen bee, and if you weren't listening to her, you weren't listening to anything. You had to turn off the radio.
Blueprint.
Drive in silence.
And she obviously burrowed into Taylor's brain somehow, because it is interesting if we could really get her on the mic talking about her original influences, like because her specific brand of songwriting at that time was so interesting. Like, yes, it was country storytelling, but it was melodic pop songwriting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it would be interesting to see who she drew that pop inspiration from. Like, there's some of it in the country music, but I'm wondering, like, what pop writers was she really into? She wasn't getting into Joni Mitchell until later. So I want to know what pop girls.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting. Probably Michelle Branch.
Avril?
Maybe. Yeah, I think she said that before, right? She said, I loved Avril. I mean, who didn't?
She said Complicated is a perfect pop song. And
what?
That makes sense, because Complicated does kind of sound like, like there's a Taylor Swift element to it, the way that it's delivered, right? So it's interesting.
It's very interesting. So long story short, it was not a great time to be presenting a teenage girl writing songs about boys to the country charts. And when he was saying this, I kind of thought the next words out of his mouth were going to be like, oh, I knew it was a risk, but I really believed in her. Maybe we can change country music together. But he did not say that. Instead, he said, because Taylor looked older, we thought we could make it work.
Ugh.
Why is this man talking so much about a 14-year-old girl's looks? I want an answer to that. And I think we deserve it.
I mean, it has to be said, though, I kind of understand. No one is going to take a 14-year-old girl that really, really looks like a young, young, young girl seriously as an artist. It's just not going to happen in the kind of music industry that she was trying to break into and Scott Borchetta had access to. They weren't – like, he wasn't – again, like we said, he wasn't doing the Disney Channel. So I can see what he's saying.
Well, she was – when her debut came out.
He took a bet on her image.
Yeah.
Not her talent. That's really the thing.
When her debut came out, she was already almost 6 feet tall. Like when she was 16, 17, she was 5'11". And it was like, what the fuck? So that I do get. Like she's
been model-esque. She's always been model-esque.
Yeah.
Especially when she was very young. Because she was very thin too. And we can't ignore that that's part of it as well.
Yeah. She had the look. She had the look. Nonetheless, Scott Borchetta was enthralled by her Abercrombie & Fitch modeling. In spite of the fact that perhaps it was a risk to take, he decided to take the risk. He invited her to come and play some music for him. And he says at the meeting, it was just her and her manager, who I think is Dan Dimtro, who later would be suing them because Scott alludes to this meeting in the email. No parents. There were no parents there. No Andrea. No Radio Disney Today.
Nope.
And,
no Bluebird Cafe.
The second song that she played for him, I thought this was really interesting. The second song she played for him was Picture to Burn. And he said, that is a hit song. And she was apparently gagged. She was like, oh, do you really think it's a hit? You know how she is. Like, oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, shucks. You think that's a good song?
Oh, shucks. You think that's good? Oh, wow. Thank you.
Was the first one Lucky You? That was the first one she played?
I don't know. I would love to know if it was Lucky You.
I'd love to know.
And
could it have been I'd Lie? Could have been I'd Lie.
Oh, and if it was, I would have turned that up. I would have been like, oh,
yep.
Sign up.
I would have said, now that
Bring the contract in. Now
that's the hit. Give it over. But Picture to Burn, that's a good song to play. Honestly, it is. Like, it's got a personality for sure. It's got a perspective.
It does.
It's sassy.
Yeah. I just listened to that song tonight, which is like, it. I mean, I know I'm a Swiftie, but like, that's random that I listened to
she
that song tonight.
She boosted
it. I love it. So Taylor said that at that first meeting where she played Picture to Burn, that there was an instant connection between the two of them in a business capacity and like a I understand you understand me type of a way. And Scott says that he was smitten on the spot, again in a business capacity, and it was like a lightning bolt. And he did love that Abercrombie and Fitch photo shoot. We know that.
He loved it.
So after this very fortuitous meeting, he says he went out and met the family. And at this point, he went to the family, you know, the people who have the wallet, we'll call it that. And he said, here's the deal. If you want to be at UMG, I will introduce you to all the executives and try to help you get signed. But you need to know something. I'm not going to be there in a year, because I'm leaving to start my own label. And the only promise I can make for you tonight is that if you wait, you have a record deal with me. And they looked at me like I was crazy. And then this is another really interesting part of the story. He said that after about 10 days, Taylor herself, not Andrea, not Scott, not Dan, called him on the phone and said, I think I kind of want to be on your label because
I believe
in your vision. And I believe it 100%. 100%.
I believe it.
And Taylor said later on that she felt like it wasn't just about getting a record deal. It was about getting the right record deal. And she felt at that time that she was with people who she believed were people she could trust. And I have no comment about that.
Oh, God.
No comment.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You know what's interesting, though, about that is that it's so true for Taylor and her family that getting signed into a 360 deal with a big label would almost certainly have led to her being shelved or her having to make artistic compromises that she didn't want to make, right, and given her a lot of resistance. With Scott, he was the only person she would have to fight with or battle with to get things done. Now, we know that it wasn't always smooth sailing, but I think that because she was able to architect her own career, that's why it's been so successful, because exactly. Scott and Andrea clearly knew what they were doing. They didn't need a bunch of executives in their ear pulling them in different directions and giving all their different advice. Like, they kind of knew what they had going on, and Scott shared the vision. And I think that's why they chose to do this. And I mean, she obviously couldn't trust him in the end, but she could trust him at the time. And he certainly delivered on his initial promise.
Exactly. I mean, that debut album is like, for a new artist, for a young artist as young as she was, that debut album is like incredible. It really is. It has like a point of view. It has a focus. It has a direct, like, I mean, everything about it is just boots.
It was very different.
Yeah.
It was innovative for what it was at the time.
Oh, yeah. It gagged me when I was a kid. It's so weird to talk about this now, because now it seems like girls that do what Taylor Swift was doing at the time are like a dime a dozen. But
dime
at
dozen,
that time,
yeah.
Oh my God, I thought I had never encountered anything like it before. The closest was maybe Avril Lavigne, but like there was just something about her that
it wasn't
was so,
that diaristic.
Yeah. No.
I think with Taylor, the thing is that you can really hear that it's coming from her. It doesn't sound like there are a bunch of writers in the room. Mm-hmm. Doesn't sound like a focus grouped message. It's not generic. It's specific.
Right.
It's visual. I mean, it's her talent.
Exactly.
On full display.
And with that, this is the longest part of the episode. We're going to get into the Scott Swift email. And ladies, it is the most ridiculous. Going through it was
insane.
I rage quit it like twice. I was like, I can't with this delusional man. Even though he was making points, every time he would make a point, he would water it down with some ridiculous declaration. I was like, I can't take it anymore. But
there's something wrong with him for sure. But I mean, getting Taylor Swift a successful career is not part of what's wrong with him.
No. There's things wrong with him, but that's not one of them.
That's the one right thing.
Yes. This was an email that he wrote to Daniel Dimtro, who he would soon be embroiled in a legal battle with. That is Taylor's first manager. That was my understanding. He was the original, the OG. And I said, perhaps don't rant and rave like a maniac to the man who you perhaps are planning on screwing over sometime in the near future. But
I mean, in writing. In writing.
You
couldn't have picked up the phone.
No.
And it reads like a train of thought. Like it's a stream of consciousness.
Oh,
this is
mad.
Not an email.
He was mad.
He was on the BlackBerry sitting outside while Taylor and Andrew were in the green room and fuming.
Yep. He was fuming. Absolutely fuming. So the email is important, especially in terms of the origins of Taylor Swift, because it was written in 2005. And any Swiftie would know 2005 is a very important year in her career. That is, this email was written a little over a year before the debut album came out. So this was prime
close
Taylor Swift time. This is like, we're about to get going here.
Art Song is getting written. Oh, really, yeah. Cooking.
She's ready in I'd Lie. She's ready in Art Song. She's putting, should have said no, pen to paper. We're going.
Mm-hmm. Spitting.
So it also gives tons of insight into what actually went into Taylor getting her start. It's not, you know, the watered down story that Taylor and Andrea tell in Journey to Fearless. That's like, oh, a Cinderella story, essentially, which we love and we clap. But mm-hmm. Mama likes a little bit of the nitty gritty, you know, behind the scenes, who's doing what, who's getting their prostate sucked out of their asshole by a robot. I mean, we need to know these things. This is a bootstrap story.
Oh, this is a story about pulling yourself up by the bootstraps and storming the Capitol.
Yep. And my favorite thing about the email, one of, I should say, is how it opens. This is how it begins. Dan, bear with me. I need to vent. And we
and
were
that's where you should have
we
stopped.
Buckled in. We buckled in. It's like, all right, let's go. Let's go. So he begins. I can already tell he's pissed as hell. And one of the first things he says that I can tell he's pissed as hell, he refers to himself as Taylor's banker, which isn't exactly a good word. You can just tell. You can hear tone. You can hear tone. And also Dan and Taylor's biggest fan is what he calls himself. That's what he says. He's a banker. He's Taylor's biggest fan. And one of Taylor's quote unquote custodians. Now there's a lot going on there. He's a banker. He's a custodian. And he's a biggest fan. He's a slave. That's what he's saying essentially.
Not father.
No, I'm
Notice
a slave.
How the word father doesn't factor into it. Custodian does. I mean, it's very transactional. It's very
He's a slave to the machine. Exactly. He feels like he's a slave to the machine. And you know what?
And he is.
As he continues on, maybe he was. I don't know. It's like he really was a slave to the machine. But that's your job as a dad. And he gets into that as well. But so, quote, we are getting to a very important time in Taylor's career. Boots. Exactly. True. Save this email. Someday you will be a dad. And you will appreciate it. Doesn't matter how much you have accomplished in your life. When you come here, you are a dad and a husband. And even Disney trashes dads. Don't laugh. You're going to be in the dads union. And no matter how well you do with Brit or Tay, Britney Spears, who did throw also, blah, blah, blah. You are a dad and your wife and kids will put you in your place. The good news is that your kids are all that matters. The rest is all crap, so you put up with it. Britney's kids won't care how great her career was. It's life. And I said, this paragraph to me is fair enough, but it's just riddled with so much mental illness. I had to itch you all. I just had to. I just burst out laughing.
The part where it gets to even Disney trashes dads, I was like, you.
What planet
this is why
you
Scott
live in?
Swift has never been interviewed. This is why a mic has never been placed in front of his face, because he spouts nonsense.
Exactly. He's a loose cannon. That's how I describe this email from start to finish. He makes points. He says something good, like, your kids are your life. You do everything for your kids. It's like, okay, great. Wonderful. Then he says, Disney trashes dads. I'm a slave. Let me out of here. Dan, help me. And it's like, okay, you gotta... you
and for the ever-controlled Taylor Swift,
this is
not a good thing.
No.
Careless man.
So one of the main things that a lot of people took issue with is how he spoke about Andrea in the email, and that starts right about now. So, quote, I am currently on email restriction from Andrea because I forwarded the Today Show jab that Chuck sent to me. I am not allowed to send Dan an email unless Andrea approves it first. Can you even comprehend that? Welcome to my world. Send it to her or mention it to Taylor, and there will probably be a quick divorce. And then he put a little emoticon. And that, to me, was the most mentally ill thing I had ever seen. I was like, this man is literally, he's got the lawyer on the phone with the divorce court.
Uh-huh.
Like, he is ready to bolt. And perhaps the only reason he didn't is because Taylor Swift was on the way to being a superstar.
I think they would not be together if it was not for the Taylor Swift career investment.
They did divorce eventually, so they
just have to pretend they like each other. And if you see them in public, they don't hug or hold hands or they're like colleagues.
They're friendly. Who does that remind me of? Like, there's a housewife who has that kind of relationship with her ex-husband. Who is that? Is it on New Jersey? Is it what's her name?
Dolores.
But I kind of like Frank is way better than Scott.
They're friendly. I think they're friendlier than this. I don't think Andrea and Scott are that friendly, but that's neither here nor there.
No, I think that it's more of like we have something in common, and that two things in common. I mean, we forget Austin exists, but he's there.
He's there.
He's there. Plus, how does
Taylor world domination?
I want to
know
more
important than anything else.
How does the check work? You know, like, does Scott get anything? Well, let's not get
into
Taylor,
that. Usually, yeah.
Well, this is too much of a conversation.
He's on email restriction. That's
so
what
we know that.
He's
we
on
know
email
that.
Restriction.
So, quote, "Thank God over the years I do not pay attention to Andrea's rules, and that's why you sleep on the couch. Andrea thinks I talk to you every day and bother you every day. I don't. I am not quite the idiot Andrea portrays me to be." And then, this is when he starts bragging about managing $270 million and 249 relationships at Merrill Lynch. I mean, essentially putting his cock on the table, as men like to do. Mm-hmm. He put his cock out.
I know my stuff. I'm a finance guy.
But my question is, are you putting the toilet seat down when you leave the bathroom?
Mm.
Are you helping with dinner every night? It's just a question.
Cricket. It's just a question.
It's just a question.
It's just a question. Are you brushing the hair? No.
No.
As we come to find out,
he
don't know how to do hair.
Let's research.
Don't know how to do hair. So, come on, mama.
So this is when, okay, so this is like immediately after this too, which cracks me up. So he says, "I found out I had cancer with Good Morning America in my living room." I think he means like it was on in the background. "Had my prostate sucked out of my body by a robot on January 4th. What a day January 4th was. Was in diapers for 7 weeks and can't get a hard on. Everyone is running at full speed. We all have our own angst to grind. And I said, I think if I had my prostate sucked out of my asshole by a robot and couldn't get a hard on, I'd probably complain about it forever too. But now what does that have to do with anything?"
It has nothing to do
you
with the matter
get
at
me,
hand.
I mean, I know he's ranting to a fellow man, a fellow person who would understand the struggle, but come on, man. Now everybody knows that you had your prostate sucked out by a robot. And then you can't get your dick hard.
Because this went into law, Taylor definitely saw this email and she had to write about her father writing about his hard-on. That's bleak. That's careless man's careful daughter.
That would make me suicidal.
Yeah.
If I had to hear something like that about my dad, I would absolutely kill myself. Like, I'm sorry.
To be fair, moment. This was never meant to be made public information. So, like, keep that in mind. This was part of a suit. But unfortunately, in business deals, anything you write down is subject to being scrutinized.
And that's why you don't write it.
They learned that lesson.
No, you'd never put in writing a robot sucked my prostate out of my asshole.
No.
So, quote, "You and Andrea have no idea how much time I've quietly, and sometimes not so quietly, stayed on top of Taylor's career while I am trying to balance all the other stuff. I'm going to do anything that I think is appropriate to advance Taylor's career." And
we know that.
He goes on to prove that. He goes on to prove that time and time again. So he starts getting into a bad business dealing that Dan had gotten himself into. This comes up a lot in the email. He essentially lost a bunch of money, I guess is what I understand from the email. I don't know the details of, and they're sparsely given, but he says about the person Dan had mistakenly invested money into. This is what he says. "The guy had just fired his band. He probably has a tattoo of his old girlfriend on his dick. He had a very wealthy father-in-law, and while I only spent a weekend with him, he was all over the board with his goals. Is he a great guy? Yeah. But he needed you more than you needed him. And he should have paid you up for your services." And you could see how that line would be very interesting to the lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Because, oh, you think that a man deserves to be paid for his services?
That's interesting. Why won't you do it?
But, and yet...
Well, this Dan person seems to be a bit of an incompetent businessman. That's kind of also the thing that I'm getting is that he was actually not doing very much for Taylor. And Scott was being kind of like nice in a sense by allowing him to share the shine of what him and Andrea were really doing. That was what I took away from this, is that his role as a manager was superfluous. Like, he wasn't necessary and it wasn't required. But Scott seems to think that he's great at this current moment.
He does say a lot of like really flattering things about Dan Dimtro in the email. He's like, well, we'll get into it. So, quote, "Taylor is worth your efforts. You hopefully will become very wealthy with Taylor." And that did not happen. "You get an A for Taylor. She is the best and she will never disappoint you. Taylor will define your life's work." I thought that was a really good quote. Like, it's very, I mean, I know he's, like, a dad, and, like, of course he has to say that, but it's, like, I could tell. He believed it. He
was, They knew. Yeah. They really knew.
Well,
they really,
like,
knew.
When we get into, like, Taylor talking about she played her guitar till her fingers bled, she was writing hundreds of songs, 100% believe that. She was working her little tail off, and I think that her parents knew that that was kind of abnormal.
Laser focused on this.
For, like, a kid of that age to be so interested.
Driven,
ambitious, so. I really like that quote, but we get one of my favorite quotes in the whole email coming up right next. When someone has tattoos all over their body, there may be issues. Well, and it reminded
me. You can't say no. Yeah, you can't say no.
It reminded me of that lyric in Ours. And any snide remarks from my father about your tattoos will be ignored. I mean,
because my heart is yours.
She tells
well.
No lies. She
it's
tells
all checking
no
out.
No lies. This is all checking,
it's all checking out.
Out. So then he says, Dan, you are the best. Do not take anything less.
Tying himself in a knot here.
Taylor's theater group, which had never been invited to sing at Municipal Stadium in Reading for the Reading Phillies, was asked to come out on Oldies Day. Here's where he starts going off. Who is on the board of directors and suggested an Oldies Day? I did. Who then offered up the cast of Grease? I did. Who had promoted his 11-year-old at every board meeting to the point that when the guy who was supposed to sing the national anthem did not show, they came to Taylor and said, can you sing the national anthem? I did. Which led to the Harlem Wizards national anthem because the person in charge of it was in the stands. God damn. This fucking paragraph is crazy. Who videotaped it? I did. Who then made copies and used old contacts to the 76ers while being told he was silly? I did. Who bought tickets for all of Taylor's friends? In quotes. Oh, so she has friends? That's by me.
You see, contradicting.
To go support her when she sang in front of 23,000 fans? I did. Who got to sit in the car?
This is my favorite part.
With her friends. Well, Andrea and Taylor were getting first-class treatment in the dressing room. I did. You will. That's not quite fair. Whose wife thinks I talk too much and promote Taylor too much? Mine. Share my pain, please. Pain?
He's trying to say, I am long-suffering dad who believes in my child more than anyone else does. And again, he said, I will do anything and everything to make her successful. And even more so than Andrea, because I think Andrea was probably more focused on being Taylor's mom, like mothering her and being her person. Scott was like, obviously he loves Taylor a lot and that's part of what he's doing here, but he's more focused on helping Taylor achieve her potential rather than like being her parent.
Right, exactly. And I think that, well, we'll get into this a little bit later because he starts talking about other kind of stuff, but I have a thought, but we'll get into it later. Who has made every single client listen to Taylor's latest song before we went over their financial plan?
I can't believe this.
Forcing clients to listen to Lucky You and Smokey Black Nights.
And didn't
like,
they?
Wow.
This is my daughter's 9/11 song. I hope you enjoy it before we go over the quarterly budget reports. Girl.
She's patriotic, Wow, girl. This is great.
She's really talented.
Can we start
so
talking
we're investing
about
the money into this?
Yeah, my portfolio now. Who then sent the 76ers tape to his attorney all the time being goofed on? Who was the president of the USTA? At that point, if Andrea was in charge, we would have talked to Kelly, gone to the US Open, and left. Who sends tapes, CDs, songs, pictures, etc., and gets to know Kelly? I don't know who Kelly is, but so she feels comfortable enough to make the introduction to you. Who pays for absolutely everything? Who was the guy that gets goofed on for talking too much? Dad. Who filmed it all? Dad. Who gets to go to New York?
Oh, this is another great one.
New England and every cool appearance. Not dad. Can't fix hair. Pick up a brush.
Come on, mama. You can do all this other stuff. You can videotape and burn a CD and hand it out to people, but you can't learn how to fix hair.
Come on. Put that hair in a pony. Let's go.
Come on, mama. I thought you said you'd do anything. You'd do anything. Come on.
There's hairdressers that'll teach you how to do a sick French braid.
Hairspray.
Come on. Dad talks too much. Who pays for trips to New York? Dad. Who makes sure and takes days off to make sure that whether it was Radio Disney, Brits Camp, or any event, that we had stuff to give away? CDs, frisbees, headshots. Who even thought to put that stuff together? This is my favorite part. Who blew up 500 beach balls on the roof for Radio Disney? The image of Scott going red in the face, blowing up Radio Disney
500
beach balls.
Times.
And it's like, now what does that do for... I'm confused about what that did for Taylor's career other than you were a fool and did a menial task that you didn't have to do. And it didn't get Taylor a record deal. It didn't.
No, did it? Was she on the Disney Channel? She wasn't.
I don't remember that. No.
She wasn't.
She was not. Then this is when Austin catches a stray, which I think is unfair. So he says, we are going to Britney's camp, but you and Austin can't come. Who gets to babysit Austin? Like, it's so horrible to spend time with your son. That was really, I was like, oh man, this is bleak for Austin. Mm-mm. They really were like, this kid is the, you know, like the parts, the spare parts.
Yeah, he's the heir and the spare. Yep. Enjoy.
Kill
you
the
do
spare.
What you need to do, queen. We've got a superstar here. You're just a kid.
Who hires staff ahead of time so that we could move to Nashville? And he says, the idiot that lives with Andrea. Oh, no. The dad can be a lonely place. So this is what I think is like this paragraph, I think, is what the email is really about. It's about he's pissed off because he doesn't get to do the fun things. Andrea gets to do all the fun things because she can fix hair. And he's a little freak who talks too much and embarrasses Taylor. And he has to stay home and babysit Austin because he's just the guy that bankrolls everything. And dad is embarrassing. That's kind of what I get from this. And he's pissed. And it's like, you're a grown man, though, sir. Why do you want to be at Radio Disney so bad?
Well, why are you telling other people this is my question.
Yeah.
It's like, these are normal dad feelings to have, I think, probably. But, you know, let's keep it to ourselves. Does the manager need to know that?
It's like he is definitely allowed to like rant and rave to his friend about something that he finds frustrating. And like, are these real problems? No. But to him, they are. To him, they are. These are his biggest problems in life. So let him.
These are his valid experiences.
Give him the microphone. Give him the microphone.
Let him rock.
this thing I... So I said, it's so funny to think about how everyone has these rumors about Scott essentially buying Taylor a record deal. And meanwhile, the reality is he, quote, picked up 5,000 little bastard rubber ducks to the point that my arms are falling off while my daughter is singing at Nashville's Duck Drop, whatever that means, and blowing up beach balls on the roof of Radio Disney. That is what he did. There was no check written, ladies.
No,
it was
girl.
Rubber duckies and beach balls.
It was woohoo time. Yeah. It was, I need to take the world's biggest breath and I need to get 10 more arms. Yeah. That's what it was. That's what was going
on
here.
Sent me. I loved these details. I was like,
I know.
He didn't think they were funny, but I think it's the funniest thing that has ever happened in the history of ever. So then he says, this part actually is kind of a bummer. He said, did I get to see Taylor's performance? Actually, no, because I was picking up 15,000 ducks out of the river. Not the brightest dad, but she did get a very high-profile gig. It's like, well, that kind of sucks. You're picking up all these
rubber
ducks.
And he is her dad. You know, that's where we can't fully villainize Scott Swift, mm-hmm. because here what he's saying is, I really wanted to see my baby get up on stage and do a big performance.
He
and I didn't
wanted
get
to say,
that, and that sucks.
That's my baby, and I'm real proud. And did he get to say that?
The chance.
No,
Andrea Swift can say, that's my baby, and I'm real proud. And Scott Swift can only pick up 15,000 rubber ducks.
Yeah.
That's all.
He's the rubber ducky boy. Get out there
Disney
and pick
up
more rubber ducks, boy.
Disney hates dads.
Disney hates dads. And the proof is in the pudding. I want to know what the fuck Nashville's duck drop is, though. What is that?
And where is the tape?
Yep.
Release the tapes.
I need to see Scott.
Give it to me. What is a duck drop? There's a lot of avian imagery. Bluebird Cafe, duck drop.
It's the origins of Taylor Swift is in the bird.
Taking flight.
In the humble bird.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the most important parts of the early Taylor Swift origins lore, as any longtime Swiftie would know, is the Bluebird Cafe. And of course, according to the origin story that has been peddled time and time again, Scott Borchetta heard Taylor play at the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville and told her he doesn't have a record label yet, et cetera, et cetera. You guys, we just talked about that. That's the original origin story. But Scott says, quote, how did we get the Bluebird? Tell us, queen. We're listening. I'm seated.
We need to know.
We go to a 3.5-hour writer's night with Rob playing at the Bluebird. Painful. That's what he says. Painful. I'm sure it is. Oh, God. I'm sure it
is. I believe you. Amateur Mike Knight at the Bluebird Cafe. Oh, no. Can't think of anything worse. Oh, no. I really can't.
Oh, no.
Not good.
It is over. Andrea wants to bolt. I go over and talk to Rob. Rob, when are you going to get Taylor in here? You should get your young writers all together. He thinks it is a great idea. Talk to Amy, and the Bluebird is in place. That is important because the newspaper article, the TV coverage, the appearance at the Bluebird did not hurt for Good Morning America. Sometimes things just happen for the right reasons. How did we find Scott Borchetta? I was told, under no uncertain terms, to not send any more CDs to Frank Bell by Andrea. That was at song 5. Right. Then he says, without Frank Bell, Scott Borchetta does not know Taylor, and we do not know him. The end. He continues, I have known Frank for longer than I have known Andrea. I don't know who this Frank guy is, but he's serving cunt. That's all I know. On certain days,
he's like the man. Key figure. If he was the man, he would be the man.
He would be the man. On certain days, I like Frank more than I like Andrea. You should go marry him. Go marry Frank. You love Frank. Frank would get in a car and drive to Nashville to save my life. He is the only one who was honest with Taylor and challenged her. And I am
okay.
Yeah, interesting. And I am not supposed to send tapes, so I sneak them out. So, time and time again, he's acting like Taylor is actively thwarting what he's trying to do. And it's not that I don't believe him, and I do believe Andrea's probably like, you're embarrassing her. You talk too much. You don't need to be doing this, that, and the other thing. And maybe she was wrong. Maybe she was, and he was totally right. But it's like he's acting like she's out here being. She acts like he's an idiot, and he acts like she's an idiot. I mean, it's divorce, babes.
And
divorce.
Really, it's Spider-Man. It's Spider-Man pointing meme. That's really yep. what it is. You both serve yep. different and essential functions exactly. functions in the Taylor Nation. Luckily for them, they realized that that was more important than their strife. To add to the lore a little bit, Frank Bell is, I think, a shareholder at Big Machine, and he was referenced in the rebuttal that Scott Borchetta posted talking about Scott's involvement with the knowledge of whether Taylor's masters were going to be sold. So we have a double betrayal, double homicide. Frank Bell, who...
But I thought you would drive to Nashville to save Scott's life.
Frank! In the middle of the night.
Frank!
He did this. He did it. Frank, come on. What are we doing, Frank?
Not Frank.
How could you do this?
I can't lose Frank,
how could you do this to me, question mark?
I can't fucking lose Frank, too.
How could you do it?
I can't lose Frank.
After making Taylor better. Come on.
Come on. You were the only one who challenged her, Frank. And now you're challenging her too much. God damn. It was betrayal after betrayal.
It be your own best friends.
So, quote, Frank knows Jimmy Hammond, who was working with Ashley Gearing. And this is, I thought this was such an interesting tidbit. He says, Ashley's career irritates Taylor and she goes to a new level. I thought
who
that
is
was
Ashley Gearing.
I looked her
did
up.
Did you look into that?
Yes. She, was a big deal in 2003. That's
oh,
it.
Oh, Lord.
So she fell off. She hasn't released anything since like 2014, 2015. But she
and
was
younger than Taylor, I noticed. Yep. I just Googled her. Mm-hmm. She's 2 years younger than Taylor.
She was irritated that there was another little girl out there playing her guitar. And she said, I will be better. Maybe that's
I
who...
need to neutralize.
Oh, my God.
I need to neutralize this threat. Wow. Just... Familiar.
Yep.
Familiar.
We just figured out who the muse of who I've always been is.
Oh, wow.
I like my trucks a little bigger. I don't know the words. Do you know the words to that song? I know. I just
no,
know
I
that
do
it,
not.
It's about, I if you never, if for those listening, if you've never heard Who I've Always Been, it's an unreleased Taylor Swift song about like, I'm country and you're not.
Mm-hmm.
It's about like,
you're
some,
not a real,
yeah, you're not,
you're
a,
not
real
a real country,
country
artist.
Girl.
This girl's from Massachusetts. Taylor, you're from Pennsylvania. So really, we should not be, you know, people in glass houses.
Yep.
Don't be doing that.
But I do think I thought it was really interesting that this person is not just like seeing competition. It's almost like it makes her better. That was what I got from Scott's comment.
It
it's
encourages
just a tiny,
her to go
I'm
harder.
Reading into it, obviously, because we have like
as we should.
But
as
I like
we should.
To, you know, I get my little eyeglasses out and I looked at it.
I'm seeing all the seeds of her personality throughout these records.
I've seen it. I mean, I'm seeing Taylor's personality. It's like we've had the read on her this whole time. Zach, we've got our finger
it's
on the
correct.
Pulse. It's correct.
Validating.
So he goes on about Frank. Quote, I was not, according to Andrea, supposed to send stuff to Frank. The press kit was not even going to Universal. This is the press kit. Frank called and said, send a press kit to Universal. Frank calls, and as the press kit is being picked up for delivery, Frank says, do not send it to Luke. Send it to Scott Borchetta in promotions. And that is how Scott Borchetta got his paws.
Got the Abercrombie.
I don't know why. I don't know why Frank Bell knew to send it to Scott Borchetta, but he did. So, Frank, we salute you. Because without you.
Thank you, Frank.
Where would we be?
We despise you.
We despise
for your
you.
Hand in the undoing, but we salute you.
We salute you at the same
we
time.
We salute and we slap.
Salute and then fucking
salute. Backhanded.
The press kit was headed out the door and Frank called. The Bluebird performance was important for Scott. And maybe I talk too much, but I am not hurting our cause. We would not know Scott Borchetta if I did not have a big mouth, is what he said.
This is and true. He's I a glad hander.
Oh, he is.
He understands what you have to do. He meets and speaks with everyone. Right. And that, you know what? This is the mistake that a lot of people make. And what Andrea, I think, is displaying here is like sometimes you look at someone and you don't see what they can do for you immediately. You should not immediately discount them or write them off. Like, you never know when you're going to need a favor in the future. You don't know who it's good to know. You should always be friendly and open with everyone that you meet that might have something to offer you if you're looking to climb a ladder exactly. or enter a rumor yes. situation. And I think that Scott, from his corporate experience, really understood that. Like, the person that you're talking to might not be able to help you directly, but they could introduce you to someone that could really rock your world, which is what happened.
Exactly. And I think that he had like such a fundamental knowledge of that coming from the business world. And like, really, if you want to boil it down to its most simple parts, Taylor got a record deal because Scott knew a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy.
Yeah. That's I mean, he's it. A businessman.
Yeah.
And I mean, the record business is a business, ultimately, yep. at the end of the yep. day. It comes down to making money, being profitable. Like, talent is maybe 20% of it, sometimes less. 80% of it is who you know, what kind of deals you can make, and like what the market is like that you're trying to break into. This was a very fortuitous happenstance of things. It wasn't just that Taylor was the most prolific teen songwriter of all time.
But at the same time, lucky
it also was
mom and neighbor luck and a starlit night and we can't you know
we can't deny it.
So, quote, I had to bite my tongue and do the right thing when you went to see Scott Borchetta with Taylor. So that was this was the meeting that Scott Borchetta was talking about. It was the right thing for me to not be there, but I want you to know how it came about that he even got the package. And I think that he thinks, and he might be right, that he's like the entire reason that Taylor got that record deal with Big Machine is because he laid out all the... He was the mastermind. He put the dominoes in a line. That's what
the dominoes cascaded in a line. Whoop!
I mean, I'm not really
seeing any lies. That's probably
true. I'm not seeing any lies.
It's probably... If we're taking this version as truth, I mean... And I don't see why he would lie about that.
Right. There's the... I mean, does he have an inflated ego? Maybe. But he was... I mean, how inflated can it be? He was blowing up fucking beach balls and collecting rubber ducks.
So when we return to Scott Swift got her a record deal, yes. But he didn't buy her a record deal.
Exactly.
He didn't buy it for her. But
it's
he arranged it for her.
Rubbing shoulders.
He set up... He put the ball on the tee and said, Taylor, swing.
Yep,
because
exactly.
she would not have gotten the record deal had she not been talented.
Exactly.
This is the important thing to remember.
Yeah. Because Scott Borchetta was really intrigued by what she had to offer.
Mm-hmm. After he got over her Abercrombie and Fitch sexy Victoria's Secret modeling teen years, after he moved past that, he was like she is talented also, as well as being 21.
Whole package. Mm-hmm. Quote, I'm going to do what I have to do to make you and Taylor successful. I am not going to get a lot of credit, but understand that I am not a contractor or plumber that does not have a clue about how to help the process, which I think
is
fair.
This is true.
It's fair.
I feel like Andrea was probably undermining, you know, the way that couples that bicker do, probably being like, oh, you're just a stupid man. You talk too much.
Yeah.
It seems as though no one ever said, thank you, Scott, for what you did for Taylor. That's kind of what it seems like at this point. And he was looking for someone to say, good job, Dad.
And was Taylor saying that from what I've read here? No. No.
She
was kicking him like a goddamn
beach
ball.
She's getting her hair fixed.
Yep.
By Andrea.
Exactly.
And singing for the ducks.
So when the RCA contract, aka the contract that Taylor initially had that she dropped, this is what Scott said. When the RCA contract was 4 months into negotiations, I did step in. Andrea told me to let you, Dan Dimtro, handle it. You did not step in, but there is a point where as a dad, you know something is not going well. And the contract between you and Taylor has taken so long for no reason at all. The RCA contract was being held up because they were negotiating over tutoring. Yes, I stepped in. What's the holdup? When I found out it was tutoring, I could not believe it. There is no tutoring in a demo deal. If I had not stepped in, we would still be negotiating and looking stupid. I was told by
Interesting.
Andrea, yep, to stay away from Arthur and Sony. Like I live in an institution and only get out on weekends. I had to quietly stop by Sony as soon as he made the offer. They called and I helped to move that along before he lost total patience. I was able to fly under Andrea's radar. Good for Taylor, you bet. So literally, the RCA contract went tits up because Scott was like, what the fuck? And he was
different ideas of what was going to make Taylor successful, like how they were going to go about doing it. And it seems as though Andrea's instincts, if we're looking at what's being laid out here from a business perspective, have not always been right.
Yep.
She seems like a wait and see or a let the people handle their business, where Scott is a lot more like, only I have Taylor's best interests at heart. So I am the one that needs to make it happen. And we see this carrying all the way through to the fucking AMC negotiations for the rights to the Eras Tour film, because it was Scott Borchetta who brokered that deal. Scott Borchetta, Scott Swift. Oh my God. Freudian slip. Scott Swift. Scott Swift was the one who set that up.
Right.
He created that opportunity for Taylor from a business perspective. Now, I'm sure Taylor was involved too, but this is tracking for me what's being said here.
It's absolutely, it makes just like so much more sense than Taylor being like, when am I going to get to make my record? You guys don't believe in me. I'm out of here.
No.
Like,
the development deal
sense.
Got held up because the contract was pending and it was a stupid contract and eventually it was going nowhere.
Period. And now we know. Then he says in all caps with like 1,000 exclamation points, we will always take care of Dan Dimtro. Well, things did not go that way.
Care to comment on that
again? Care to comment. So after that long spiel, he starts talking about facts and figures. This part is very interesting. So, quote, I am not about money. And Taylor is not, and I know you are not, but you should know what has been spent. There is no money that you spend on your children that you mind, but I wish I had a banker like you and Taylor have. When you said, let's do every woman, it was a great idea. It kills me to think that Scott and Dan Dimtro were like, what song should Taylor cover? I know, I'm every woman.
13 years old. Not a note in her head.
I'm every woman.
No,
it's
wrong.
All
wrong.
In me.
And they spent, how much did they spend on it, Madeline?
$4,600 to make I'm every woman.
That, and that's $4,600 too much.
It put me in my tomb. I was like, what? And I thought that was interesting because I was like, that demo sounds like shit. Let's start there. And B, a normal person who's trying to make it does not have a spare $5,000 to spend on I'm Every Woman.
On one song as well. On one song. That's not even your song.
And he spent it, baby. And what did it do for us? Well, I don't know. I mean, you could argue maybe the people liked it. I know I didn't. And I'm a stan.
It was heard.
Yeah,
it
was heard. So then it says
he takes another jab at Andrea here by saying, not counting the stuff Andrea may or may not have bought while over in Rob's neighborhood where all the shops are. Wow. Okay.
So she's spending all the money. But it's like, well, you have extra money, so let her go buy a bumblebee brooch.
You got $4,600. Exactly. You got $4,600 to spend on this atrocity that you unleashed on the world. I think Andrea deserves another black top.
I think she does. And he also says that the demo, Your Face, nearly cost $8,000 to
that,
make.
Madeline.
That put me in my fucking tomb.
That I would love an itemized breakdown of the cost of each and every one of those demos. Your $8,000 on Your Face.
That shocked me. I was like, for that? I mean, even.
I wouldn't spend $500 on that.
No. I'd be like,
$8,000.
However, I would spend $8,000 on Lucky You in a heartbeat. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, I have full faith in that song.
Sweet Tea and God's Grace is $80,000.
$80,000?
$100,000. Let's keep going.
$100,000. No.
$1,000,000? We're getting into the billions.
Yeah, we're getting into the billions. So then he says, quote, there is an excess of $150,000 hard dollars spent on travel lessons, production, and in parentheses, $29,000, not counting duplication, website, not many artists have a website like ours. And I knew that was the goddamn truth. That website in 2006 was a
period Slade.
It was
boost.
I remember opening it when I was just a wee tot and being like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever.
Butterflies
and little buttons and stuff. Like, it was so,
see, he knew. He was making moves. He really was. Yeah. He was like, you got to spend money to make money. And that amount was $150,000.
And it was worth every penny.
Look where we are now. And he's made it all back.
Then he says, again, another stray for Austin. He's just catching strays left and right. Quote, as a financial planner, is it fair to Austin that Taylor is taking her half of the estate now? Probably not. And this is where he puts another emoticon with a smiley little emoticon. That is the most deranged thing I've ever read
but
in my life.
But fuck my normal untalented child.
He's nothing.
Who cares about that one? He's a rat.
He's a rat. He's a useless little rat.
I have the goose over here, the golden goose. Yep. She's laying eggs. She needs the money.
He's got nothing. All he has is Jack Leopards and the Dolphin Club. And that's not getting him any checks.
And he got one acting role. And he dressed up as Santa Claus.
Was that him? Was that confirmed him?
That was him.
Why is he so opposed to like being a normal person?
Imagine Taylor Swift being your sister and this being your dad. I mean, it's not easy. It's not easy when you live in the shadow for your whole life.
I dress up
He's
as Santa too.
He's remarkably quiet for that.
I'd put on my glasses and I'd put on my Santa
beard.
Yeah,
I'd be in a disguise.
And I'd be like, that's it, because I'm sick of this shit. Buy me my Porsche and I move on. Mm-hmm. Get out of my fucking face,
exactly.
Taylor. I can't fucking stand you.
Period.
All right, quote. This is when he's talking about the move to Nashville. Quote, the move, delightful as it has been, involved moving out of two houses and all the crap you had to put up with times 10. The expense has been over $200,000, not counting that I am being taxed in Pennsylvania and Tennessee. This year it was $31,000. Without us moving here, Taylor is not where she is today. And it's crazy to me to hear the money numbers being spouted and to think about Taylor and Andrew just being like, we just picked up and moved to Nashville. And meanwhile, Scott is like, it cost $500,000 and it was a fucking nightmare. And I'm getting taxed here, there. I had to sell my beloved childhood Jersey Shore beach house so that we could move to Nashville. Like, this is.
And that probably isn't even including the cost of the house, because he's just talking about the moving costs, like getting everything from point A to point B. If you've been to that house, which I have, it's gorgeous and it's very expensive. You look at it and you're like, oh, we're talking millions.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
What did he say?
So you can put a price on it, Taylor Swift moving to Nashville.
What did he say about the cost? I had this written down. Oh, so when he sold the Shore House, the Jersey Shore House, he bought it for less than $500,000 and he sold it for $2.5 million. That's how much
he got.
So
why are we complaining, mama?
Yeah, well, that's
why are we complaining?
Boo hoo.
What are we complaining about? Boo fucking who?
Can't feel bad for
And who forced you to move to Nashville?
Nobody. They're moving for beach balls and ducks. And they're smiling as they're doing it.
You want to perform at the duck parade?
Yeah.
God, imagine if it didn't work out. I would be
oh my
so
God, I would be
fucking imagine if she actually gearinged it
and she
one
just
song,
fell off the face of the earth
and you're done, you're Jover. Wow. Boo.
I'd say
Austin, at the end of it, he probably spent $1 million on this.
Yeah.
On getting Taylor,
oh yeah,
getting Taylor all together.
So it's interesting to think about, like, well, no, he didn't buy her a record deal, but
there would be no way.
So, I mean, it's not quite nepotism. It's just like, it's hard to judge.
Privilege.
Yeah,
it's privilege.
I always think about, I read something once that said that, like, it's almost impossible to jump classes. Like, there's very few stories about genuinely, like, Chapel Roan is
Class
a really
mobility.
Good example of somebody who had to work fucking three jobs for her demos
after getting a record deal.
Yeah.
After getting a record deal and getting dropped.
And it's like, you just don't see things like that happen. You just don't. I mean, that's kind of why I really like the Chapel Roan story. And she feels like such a genuine artist. You know what I mean? Like a real person who is that talented and that driven and that ambitious. So it's kind of like,
and Taylor was also allowed to still go to school. She still got a good education because her parents could afford to facilitate that for her. They still were able to offer her a degree of normalcy. She could go out with her friends, and her parents also were present. Her mom got to not be at work every day and be with her on all of these things so that she felt supported and so that people couldn't take advantage of her.
Exactly.
So this is why Taylor's experience as a child star differs so greatly from someone like Demi or Selena or Britney, people that are coming from a place of, we need to make this happen, not we want to.
Right. Justin Bieber is actually another really good example of like somebody
that's the
who
saddest
classes,
one, I think.
And that's the saddest one. Like,
completely.
He's like
a broken
they
person.
Sold him into it so that.
Yeah,
you know what
they
I mean?
Sold his soul.
Yeah.
Something bad happened to that kid.
Yeah.
Like he. Not Taylor, though.
We clapped and we cheered. Not our girl.
Not our girly.
So then we continue with this, with Mr. Scott. He says, do I regret any of this? No. But if I'm the one that has to go into Nashville and spend a day in court while Andrea's in LA, if I'm the one that has to spend a half day setting up trust for Taylor, if I am the one that pays the lawyers and pays Andrea's way and takes care of you with $5,000 bonuses, would like some return on my investment. And you fucking got it. You got
it. So I was kind of like, what is he doing about like the correspondence here? What is he responding to? He seems to be trying to prove something and defend himself or excuse something. So I'm kind of like, I need to see the email that came from Dan before this one. Like, what was the impetus for this? It could very well be that he just wants to run his mouth, because it seems like he would do that to anyone at any point.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Andrea kept telling him, shut up.
Yep. Shut up. And he's like, well, I got to.
And he should
somebody.
Have.
Dan, can you.
Shouldn't
can
have put
I...
it in writing, that's for damn sure.
Yeah, you should definitely not have done that. Quote, how did we get the relationship with Taylor Guitars? Because once Taylor bought her first guitar, I called the company and kept them up to date with what Taylor was doing. And I thought that that was crazy and like deranged, but I mean, can we fault him?
So smart.
Yeah, when it
so,
worked.
So smart. Yeah. And Taylor Guitars, I believe, was not. Were they that big at the time? I think that they're like, obviously they were known by musos and music industry heads, but I think that Taylor definitely introduced them to a brand new mainstream audience of young people that were going to start picking up Taylor guitars. Remember the Taylor Swift branded guitar? Genius marketing tie-in. Also, gorgeous guitar. I have it.
Really nice guitar. They were really, really nice. I wanted one so bad. They were too expensive though.
They're really pretty.
They were like really pretty guitars. My parents would never buy that for me.
By the time I got them, they had stockpiled them in Singapore and nobody wanted them anymore. So I got mine for like 400 Singapore dollars, which is like 200 USD, which
That's
is crazy because they were going for like a grand, I think. But anyway.
What I wouldn't give. then he says, we are at a critical time. And period. Yes, you are.
He was right.
You don't even know what kind of a critical time you're at. You have no fucking clue. So he says then that Andrea doesn't know about the mortgage or the finances. But then he says, I'm not putting her down because she would rather have molten lead poured over her head than talk finances. So he's like, she doesn't know anything.
That's her right.
But she doesn't want to know. So I don't blame her. So, I mean, I don't want to know either. I mean, he's a finance guy. And
he wants to know.
Yeah.
He has all the numbers off the top of his head. He can tell you what his taxes were, how much the expenses cost, what he spent on the Your Face demo.
Yeah.
Like, clearly... numbers.
Yeah, he's a numbers man. Quote, Scott Borchetta has never been and will never be the typical record guy. Like you, there's something special about Scott. I know you have been molested by Jive. I didn't care for the use of the word by Jive, but you were going to tell me I was right. Years from now, he lives and dies for his artists. This is not from him.
Oh, if that were true.
But from people who have had to go up against him. And I thought that
very interesting. You know who would be characterized exactly like that? Scooter Braun.
He lives and dies for his artists.
Mm-hmm. And that's more importantly known from people who have had to go up against him, bullying, going the extra mile. Interesting that they would later become best comrades.
Well, they're the same, you see. I've always felt that way. I mean, not before. I'm not like some kind of soothsayer. I didn't know this before, like the sale. But like when I saw them together, do you remember that disgusting magazine article? That
I hate it. Where they're sharing whiskey on the rocks. I will never forget.
I was like, that's the same person. I like both they're identical. They're fucking identical.
Pigs. I hate them.
I say this is one of the weirdest lines in the email. Oh, I don't remember this. Madeline well, of the past? Talk to me about it. So, now I'm remembering. So this is what he says. This is fascinating. Quote, manage Taylor to greatness as a writer, one strategy. As a singer, another strategy. And as an eventual movie star, she has the talent.
That she has the talent, yeah, in brackets after movie star kills me.
Well,
because that's your blind spot, babe. No, she doesn't.
I found it so fucking interesting because it's like it's not even so much about like he believes in Taylor's songwriting or her singing or her acting. Mm-mm, he doesn't believe in any of it,
yeah,
necessarily. What he wants and believes is that she is a star. By any means necessary, I will make her a star. That's what I read into that. And I'm not saying that as a bad thing. I think he just
there's
knew.
Some truth to that.
Yeah, well, she has an X
but
factor.
Let me tell you, it was not going to be singer and it was not going to be actor. Period.
Writer. And it's, yeah, kind of, I mean, she was writing books at the time.
It's not like he didn't identify it as a skill set, right, of hers, but it is interesting, as you said, that he had an array of ways to do this.
Right.
I mean, this is a really important and rare parent to have as a child star. Like, who can be this? And the way that he set up most of her business things, like he's setting up trusts, as he says here, trusts that he likely can't touch, money that will be like protected for Taylor that she makes, et cetera. Like, I don't think Britney Spears' dad was doing that for her.
Oh, no. I don't think he was. And it's really kind of like people took so we're not done yet, but like people took so much negativity from this email. There's a lot. If you really sit down and you really think about what he's saying, like, this is somebody a man who would do anything to make his daughter's dreams come true. That's literally, I mean, it's like, yeah, he's a fucking dick and he says gross stuff, but he's an asshole. But it's like, I mean, are you going to deny that he didn't play a pivotal role in her getting to see her dreams come true and to be the biggest star on the planet? I mean, are you really going to? It's crazy.
You can't be a Swiftie and deny the impact of Scott Swift. I mean, if anything, my suspicions that he's kind of a doofus are confirmed, but my respect for him has grown because he set about a goal that he wanted to achieve and he achieved it.
Exactly.
And he made all of his daughter's dreams come true.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
Careless
man. I'm shrugging. Sure. Quote, we need to prepare as a family. And maybe you have laid out a plan with Taylor and Andrea, but they have not communicated it with me. Do we take off as a family or do we break up the family and Austin and I live here and Taylor and Andrea hit the road? What kind of money are we going to sink in? I thought this was interesting because it's like,
this is right before her and Andrea, yeah, packed into the van and started, yeah, driving around and going to the radio stations and shaking, yeah, hands. So clearly that is actually what they did.
Right.
And as we know, because Scott didn't have a label and had no money, I would imagine that all of that early promo stuff that Taylor did was bankrolled by the banker. The banker.
Daddy.
The dad who Disney hates.
Daddy, I need you to come blow up beach balls today, Daddy. And guess what?
And give me $5,000.
Money, please.
To make a cover of I'm a Money, please. In a certain sense, Taylor was born Money, please.
Yes. Money, please. So up next, we have the main quote that makes me think that Taylor was absolutely mortified by her dad. So he says, if I mention the Jim Reeves investment, please don't discuss it with my daughter, who treated me like I was an idiot for trying to lock up a 32% return. Dan does not even know who Jim Reeves is. That's what Taylor said. You are a god, and I am just dumb dad. I was like, oh, she hates your ass. She's not saying
this
thank
you.
This
last part, this next part is so deranged.
This is
so unbelievably, yeah, deranged.
Finally, if you want to get rid of me, please forward this to Andrea. I will then move out of the country because, like you, in 15 years, if not now, you will live in fear of your wife. This is the last positive email I will ever send you. Now, I have to get back to work so I can pay for some event that I won't get to go to. You could have a worse dad to work with and no finances, which of course will happen if you mention this email to Taylor or Andrea, since I am on email restriction to you. Don't laugh. Scott Swift, Dad's Union number 173, and period. That is the email.
In a certain sense, this is a work of art.
It is. It's
in
it's,
a in a this is it's poetry. It's drama. It's a screenplay.
It reminds
it's a novel.
Me of like a Donald Trumpian sort of an email. Like this is the kind of nonsense.
It really is.
Yeah. This is the kind of nonsense.
It shocks me. I knew we had to do an essay, an episode about it when I read it, because I was like, this is for the mentally ill girlies that have been there from the beginning.
Oh yeah.
Like this,
this is for us.
To me, this is the tea that I love to receive. Like this is really what I want to know, the nuts and bolts of.
Exactly.
Very illuminating.
Yep.
Very clarifying. Mm-hmm. And as he said, it was in a very pivotal part of the career.
Oh, it was. And I really enjoyed, I mean, overall, I the nuggets that we got out of it, I thought were very enjoyable. I mean, is he psycho? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, he was making moves.
$8,000 for your face? I needed to know that.
Boots on the ground.
I needed to know.
I mean, how much did I'd Lie cost? I mean, we need to get a return on that, don't we? Let's go. Debut TV, let's go. Let's get our money back.
Let's make that money back.
Yeah.
We'll do it.
We'll do it.
But mad respect, honestly.
Yeah.
Mad respect. And the Andrea and Scott strife really does not surprise me.
No.
Like, that doesn't surprise me at all. What does surprise me is how it seems like the family operates in this weird communication silo where they're each having separate conversations with the various business people involved in Taylor's life, right, including Taylor, because Taylor is
Taylor's
getting her
on
feedback.
The phone.
Taylor's at 14 years old calling her dad a dumbass for talking about Jim Reeves.
Yeah.
So clearly, I think it was like mother-daughter ganging up against stupid dad. That really seems like the dynamic that was going on. And
isn't that every dad's cross? You know what I mean?
It is.
It really is.
Disney hates dads.
Not in my family. I will say that. Like in my family, it was me and my dad versus dumb mom, which is why. Oh,
I gang up against my dad with my mom all the time. Always.
It's there's always one parent who's like the whipping pole.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is in every family. Mm-hmm. And it's like the people who we perceive to be like, oh, we're the smart ones. And like, you're like.
Sad thing I think about this in general is like hearing how Austin Swift is like a non-factor. Truly.
He cuts rays. It was like he's not even a thought in anybody's head. I would have been if I was Austin. I mean, no wonder he was emotionally eating. I understand you, Austin. No,
yeah.
You're forgotten. Mm-hmm. Totally forgotten. You got to do something. Pizza party.
It's unfortunate. We got accused of body shaming Austin before, so I don't want to participate.
Oh, you don't?
In
that well, I'm again. Allowed to do it. Look at me.
You do it. You do it.
I'm
saying nothing.
I'm allowed to
I'm
do it. If anybody's listening to this, I need you to know what I'm saying is I'm the same as him. So
you understand.
I understand.
I'm an emotional eater too. I get it. It's hard. It can be hard when you feel like, well, what we can't relate to is having the biggest superstar in the world as your older sister.
No.
And that is an experience I would never like to have.
I would have done a lot more than emotionally eat. You would have come home and find me hanging from the shower rod.
You would have found me on January 6th doing meth behavior.
Yeah.
That's where I would have been.
Oh,
meth
well,
behavior.
That, honestly, it kind of surprised me. He's kind of grown up to be normal. Like, why isn't he storming the Capitol? Like, just to get some attention. You know what I mean?
Can we
like,
do it?
What do you mean?
Can we get him to do it?
Oh, can we get, can we like
inspire him to do it?
Well, let's be the devil
I'm
on
also
a shoulder.
Like, how does the money work? Do you think they just give him money? Does he work? Because they say Taylor refers to the four of them as a unit as her family business. I read somewhere that he's doing licensing. Austin is doing licensing. So I would imagine that he's like, you've never seen Succession, but Roman Roy, who is like the kind of the Joker of the family, they give him like a ceremonial title.
More like Rob Kardashian.
Yeah, but yes. Actually, yes. Just like Rob Kardashian. Do you want to go into a little bit about the lawsuit?
Yes. So obviously I'm not a lawyer, you know, I was just kind of poking around and getting my information.
Did a little research.
You know, I did a little research. I did like open up the actual legal document and I started to like poke through it to get some general overview. But it's like, I don't know what the hell's going on. Legalese. That's not my. So I mostly I looked up like what I had other people read it. And then I read what they said. So
amazing.
Daniel Dimtro plaintiff versus defendants Taylor Swift, Scott Swift, and Andrea Swift. It was a civil action suit. Daniel Dimtro is a manager in the music industry who also once represented Britney Spears. He agreed to represent Taylor when Taylor was 13 years old, and the relationship continued for 2.5 years. And he says that he, quote, devoted a significant amount of time towards planning Taylor Swift's career, helping to sharpen her talent and skills, exposing her to career-building opportunities, and identifying and negotiating lucrative contracts. He also didn't mention his email relationship with Scott Swift. I mean, he was fielding emails from Scott. If I had to deal with that, I would have been like, and also
that would have been number one Scott's greed receiver.
Yep, exactly. Scott and Andrea agreed to work with Dimtro to obtain court approval of his contract with Taylor Swift. However, they, quote, repudiated their agreements with Dimtro weeks before signing a contract, that's with Big Machine Records, in an attempt to deny him his bargain for compensation for payment of the reasonable value of his services. Essentially, Dimtro was suing the Swifts for the payment he believes he's owed for services rendered. He also claims that they planned, this I thought was funny, he said that there was a conspiracy and they planned to screw him out of his money, them being Scott Swift and Borchetta specifically. He was the one who introduced the Swifts to Scott Borchetta. That's what he says.
That's negated by Scott's email, which is included in the suit.
I thought it was Frank
really
Bell.
That one went.
I thought it was Mr. Frank.
Yeah. That he was not even mentioned at all,
yeah,
actually.
And as her manager, he would have been entitled to 5% to 7% commission for Taylor's music career, including any deal she would have made with Borchetta. Dimtro's attorney, his name is, I like his name so much, it's Fernando Pinguelo. I mean,
ooh, beautiful name. Sexy
it.
Man, I know.
Sexy. I know he's hot. I know it's big. Fernando Pinguelo says, quote, they delayed and delayed the deal and got rid of my client and subsequently signed the deal and kept his commissions for themselves. And Dan Dimtro says that he was only paid $10,000 for what he describes as essentially launching Taylor Swift's career. But, I mean, what about these $5,000 bonuses that Scott Swift said?
I know. He mentioned that a couple times. And also, what did you do? I'm still not clear on exactly what services were rendered. He says sharpening her talent, but it doesn't really get more specific than that.
None of it. I mean, if you look in the legal document, it has like individual things listed. But a lot of it is like, I just seems pointless to me. Like when I was reading it, I was like, okay.
Supported her development as an artist, things like that.
Yeah,
like vague things that
like
can't
that.
Be
like,
substantiated.
I drove the van to Radio Disney. And
he also didn't launch. I think, if anything, that email really proves that Scott Swift hard launched Taylor Swift's career, for sure.
I will say this, when I read this, it shocked me. This is like the smoking gun, I guess you could argue, of like Dimtro and his lawyers like whole case. Apparently there's an email from August 2006. This is not the one that we just read. I wish I had my hands on this one, though, I tell you what. So from Scott Swift to Scott Borchetta, enough with the Dimtro. You asked me to break both his legs, wrap him in chains, and throw him in the lake. I did.
Well, that's show business.
That's show business. But I mean, it's
that's
a very dramatic
show business.
I think all he means is, well, he's not serving us anymore, and I don't like his
work. You wanted him out of the picture.
And I want him
out of the picture. Getting this sense from the email that Scott was sending to begin with, that Scott didn't think a whole lot of his services anyway.
Right.
And he was just kind of like being nice because they had a contract. But the legal response is interesting. They gave.
So this is what the defense said. So Taylor Swift was under 18 when she signed the contract with Dimtro. And since the contract did not have court approval, which is law in New York for a minor, Swift and Borchetta's lawyers claim the contract is null and void. But they did not attack the merits of the contract itself, though they did say Dimtro was grossly exaggerating his impact on
period.
His career, which is true.
Period.
Come on, bitch. You just want, I mean, I understand it. You want your ticket, you want your meal ticket. I get it, but come on. Be so for real. So I was when I was looking this up, I found conflicting things. I saw one person said it's over and the only thing that stuck was this, and then somebody else said it's still ongoing, but we have
I wouldn't think that it's still ongoing. They
like,
probably settled out of court.
So
I would think that
here's what happened. Most of the charges were thrown out, which I'm not surprised about. The resolution of the case on the one count that is stuck, which was unjust enrichment, has been kept strangely secretive. So we don't know what the money, if he got paid out or what happened, et cetera.
I would imagine a lump sum offered and then an NDA signed. Yeah. Gag order, so I would presume.
Unjust enrichment is when one party benefits at the expense of the other party, which is obviously, well, yeah, that's, you know, I mean,
sure.
Sure.
Why not? Why not? That's business. That's show business, and you're a fool. You weren't smart enough to get in when the going was hot. You clearly didn't do what you needed to do. You weren't useful. The other two men knew what they were doing and helped Taylor get where she needed to go.
Exactly. And you know what? It's cutthroat. It's cutthroat. It's business.
It's not personal. It's a swift eat borshetta world out here.
It's
a swift eat dimtro world.
It's a swift eat dimtro world out there, babe.
That's the way it's got to be. Are you going to be a swift in your life, or are you going to be a dimtro?
I want to be a swift, personally.
Me too.
So. We have to kill
I don't
them.
Want to be Scott Swift.
No,
don't,
no,
don't
no,
want
no,
my prostate
no,
sucked out by
no,
a robot.
No,
no, thank
no,
you.
No, please, please.
No, 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 please, please, please spare me. Well, what an episode, Madeline. Thank you for doing your bone collecting.
Well, you know what? Every now and then I have to dust off my, you know, forensic tools. I have to go to the dig site. I have to brush off the bones, and I collected them. And I have to tell you, I kind of really enjoyed doing it. I mean, did I love dissecting the email? No. But I got some really good stuff out of it. And I feel like after that, we have a really well-rounded picture of what the origins of Taylor Swift really were. And I hope that you guys all feel the same, because I feel good about it. Yeah.
And who else could have done it other than your bone collector and your messy boots on the ground reporter?
Exactly. Exactly.
Don't forget to sign up to the Patreon for more of this incredible content. We do, in fact, have a Gaylor deep dive, which I assure you is hilarious. So please go and listen to that. And we will be back at you with another public episode, a surprise, later this month. Goodbye.